Director of Directors, directly to your ears, Graham Harper. Courtesy of Southside.
You're absolutely right, Graham. You know, all of these years, I mean, I know we produced that jingle for you, I think, back in 2001 originally, or maybe just a few years after that, and you know, we haven't actually sort of done one for Shane Rimmer. We'll have to put that right. Graham, you're in the studio. How are you?
I'm very well. Hello. I'm really good.
Hi. Even more exciting, Shane Rimmer is in the studio as well. Shane Rimmer and Graham Harper in the house, quite
Whoa,
literally.
What a double bill, eh?
And it gets even better. It's not just two juices, it's three juices, because Sheila Rimmer is with us as well. Hi. Formerly Sheila Logan. Good to see you, Sheila. How are
Hi.
You?
Hi. Well, thank you.
Fantastic stuff. Graham, Bernadette's obviously doing some wonderful stuff as a studio audience person, keeping two thumbs up. Great. Quelle jolie, as
she
we always like
to
say.
Quiet.
It's very good. But last year, of course, it was the second Middlesbrough Literary Festival, the reason, of course, that we're here. And we went off to Saltburn-on-Sea to actually have a sort of post-festival event.
That was fabulous.
It was very good. I sadly couldn't offer the same to the Rimmers last night, so I just left them in the hotel and they wandered around Middlesbrough finding it completely deserted. It's a thought. I'll put it right as well from that point of view. But what are your thoughts now? We're into the third Middlesbrough Book Festival. It's going to be in the Middlesbrough Central Library.
I hope, on behalf of all the organisers, there's just a few more people than there were. So come on, everybody! You've got to come and have a good browse, and also come and listen to us and ask questions.
Exactly. Well, I figure we're going to have a heck of a show put together. I mean, that's the key thing. We've put three lined whips on to ensure that things get sorted through. Shane, when we were talking last night, you said you might have performed in Middlesbrough, but certainly in your book you quote West Hartlepool, in particular the hot part of the stone in West Hartlepool as your fondest northeastern memories.
Yes, it was so cold. I can't express how cold it was.
Really?
And there were children out there getting sea coal. I never seen that before in my life. I wish I could have got some and kept myself a bit warmer than I would. No, I unfortunately, I only saw it in the winter. And I think the winters are pretty severe out in West Hartlepool.
Well, they used to be. Now it's all been reurbanized. It's all perfectly well. It's all
right.
I was just actually thinking, Graham, the last time you were together in the same studio with Shane and myself must have been Dulwich Radio. And it must have been probably 1986-87.
Goodness me.
Yeah, so we're calling it a quarter of a century ago before those times. I mean, you actually had arrived on the scene about two or three years before Shane Rimmer graciously said, yes, I'll come along and do it. But it's fine. In fact, it all failed in the back. I remember. It's all sorted out, filed from that perspective. I think it was when Sheila said, you can do your
first. I remember going to Dulwich Hospital and hoping I would get out of it. It was a very impressive building. I mean, I hope I didn't have some sort of injury or something on the way in and out. It was that Victorian or Edwardian or what?
Yes, Victorian.
Right?
Yeah.
It was an immense
old place, fashioned Victorian hospital. Yeah.
Yeah.
And here we are live in the James Cook University Hospital.
It's very modern.
It is completely different. And I think the last time you were in the studio here, Graham, was it our 36-hour marathon or 37-hour marathon that we were doing?
It was, yeah.
It was that, yeah. Because you'd missed Tony Blair. We'd done Alan Bennett. Yes, it's all fading in the background.
I missed both of those, which is a shame.
We'll sign up again.
Tony Blair doing Southside's brilliant.
He heard that Shane Rimmer had done it, so obviously he had to get on the bandwagon.
Well,
it was his way.
Definitely.
It was the crucial sort of things. Coming up on the show today, slightly smaller than normal. We're not doing 36 hours, you'll be pleased to know, Graham. It's just going to be a straight hour or so, but we are going to fit in a mystery voice for yourself. We'll be speaking to Alan Stevens, who's an author who's indeed interviewed yourself on stage, Graham.
But it's not a mystery then, is it, if it's Alan
Stevens? No, there's another mystery voice.
Oh, right.
Another mystery voice from that point of view. And to give advice to Shane Rimmer, because she was in exactly the same position as you were in this year, Shane, having to take the photographs in the chair here, the photographs on the other side, the constant sort of scenario of driving, holding up a book, etc. She'll be giving you some advice on how to actually cope with the Literary Festival today.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's his mystery voice.
That's Michelle Monroe.
Oh, right.
Because curiously, as I found out recently, the connections get even more bizarre. Sheila was one of Matt Monroe's early managers. Isn't that right, Sheila?
Indeed, yes. Many years ago.
Was this when he was Terry? Or was he Matt?
No, he was Matt.
So he was actually Matt. He hadn't changed his name from the whole thing there. So there we are. So,
that is extraordinary.
And hopefully the five of us will all be celebrating with Michelle at the Matt Monroe launch in September as well. So it's
good.
Just party times. Left, right and centre.
Musically
speaking, what would you like to go for, Graham? I'll give you first choice. Any particular artists that we have in mind?
We heard a fantastic piece of music last night, which you probably haven't got.
Probably haven't got it, but
okay. You know, you can I can't remember the name. It's true. What can I say? I'd love some David Bowie.
You'd like some David Bowie.
And Changes would do, or whatever.
Yeah, well, you see, obviously, you are on the directorial board of our very own Southside Broadcasting here, and that's what you've got. Thought he might have gone for Small Faces, but no, he went for Bowie, and quite rightly so too. It is time now, Graham, for you to rejoice in every simple sense of the word, because you're going to be interviewing Sheila Rimmer.
It's going to be good.
It is.
Well, I don't know about the interview, but what's going to be said by you, I'm sure, will be wonderful. Sheila, I've just discovered that you were a manager, and an agent, and a dancer. Did you look after Shane? Is that how you met?
She still doesn't, but it's all right.
Yes, and talking, we're back, going back to the 60s. I was a dancer. I had a dancing act called the Three Martinis, and we did all the Moss Empire tours, including Middlesbrough Empire, West Hartlepool, good Birmingham, God, everywhere else. And on one of those tours, I met the Three Deuces, the vocal act from Canada. Shane had just left them, so I didn't meet him there. And they were talking to me and, you know, saying Shane had left and they'd replaced him. And then a year or two later, I was in Germany doing the American Forces route, you know, with variety acts. And I met this singer singing on his own called Shane Rimmer. And he said, I used to be in an act called Three Deuces. And I said, oh, I know them well.
How extraordinary. Yeah.
So, so I was dancing. We then came back to England. We got married. And then I was still dancing, and we never saw each other. He was in one place and I was in the other. And a booker from Germany, an American, said, why don't you go back to London, open an agency, get a license, because I can't get one in London, because I don't live there. I'll feed you the variety acts from America, and you can run the office, and we'll split it 50-50. And he actually gave me, I didn't want to do it, Shane said I'd be good doing it. The guy gave me £3,000 and said, go and get some office furniture, find an office. And in Piccadilly Circus, Victoria Mansions, Shane found the office.
I know Victoria Mansions. Good God.
And that's where I was for a few years. And we had children who used to drive up from the country where we lived with the baby in the car and all that, you know. And so I was booking him then while he was still singing until he got the first Dr. Strangelove acting job.
Yeah. How extraordinary.
Yeah.
Where did you train? Where did you train to be a dancer?
I trained at the Arts Educational School in Tring, which is everything, tap, a lot. And then I went, when I was 12, I went to the Legat School of Russian Ballet in Tunbridge Wells, and I did ballet and went into their company.
Wow, okay.
For about 4 years. And then I got fed up with bleeding toes, so I started a modern dancing act, which was much more fun.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. I went to a drama school called Italia Conti, so I know all about arts education, because we were always...
I just think, actually, Graham, bleeding jobs. Toes would make a heck of a name for a band, actually.
And I know somebody...
write that down, copyright it.
Bleeding toes.
We're on the case. Coming up shortly, Alan Stevens.
If an insurance company representative knocks at your door and tries to get you to accept a cheque following a motor accident, what should you do? Let's ask Charles Ather.
What you should do is be very suspicious. If they're offering payment before you've even made a claim, then I believe they must think your claim is worth far more. Whatever you do, don't sign away your rights.
So if you're approached in this way...
Remember, you have a right to choose your own solicitor and get a proper assessment of your claim.
Call Middlesbrough 222-575 or text advice to 81400 now. Choose the one.
Thank you. Strokes affect 130,000 people in England and Wales each year. Here's a recipe that can dramatically decrease your chances of strokes.
Excellent. I better get a pen.
167 grams of calcium, 225
grams of magnesium, 3 grams of magnesium. Hang on, slow down.
Remember, any more than one tablespoon could kill you. Any less than one tablespoon could kill you.
Right, what was
the recipe? That's the recipe.
Oh,
if you would like a more simple solution, you can always call Pharma Nord on 01670 519989.
All right.
Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
Let me see if I can jot that down. What was the number again?
01670 519989. Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
And how do you spell Pharma Nord, I wonder?
pharmanord.co.uk.
It's almost as if I'm having a conversation with the radio.
Don't be silly, that's impossible.
Pharma Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
At Roseville, we aim to provide a high-quality, caring environment, not just in the eyes of the regulatory bodies that audit and evaluate the services we provide, but more importantly, in the hearts and minds of the customers who use them, our service users. All service users are assured that they will be treated with respect and dignity according to their individual needs and wishes. Roseville operates a strong diversity policy in respect of residents and is committed to ensuring no one is excluded on the grounds of their ethnicity, religion or culture. We want service users to have the freedom to live their preferred lifestyle with the choice of independence or participation, individuality or community. Our aim is to provide a level of care and support that meets the needs of the whole person, and by that we mean the physical, psychological, social and spiritual well-being of the service user we care for. But above all, we aim to do all this in a safe, comfortable and homely environment. To find out more, please telephone 01642 30 8188 or email us at info@rosevillecarecentre.com.
Charles Ather of Ather & Co. has important information for anyone injured in an accident at work. Go on, Charles.
Many people don't realise that in law, employers have a huge duty of care. Even if your actions contributed to the accident, you may still be able to claim compensation.
So even if you think you may have been partly to blame...
Yes, talk to us and we'll be able to advise on whether you have a claim.
Call Middlesbrough 222-575 or text CLAIM to 81400 now. That's CLAIM to 81400 now. Choose the one you know.
We still haven't brought up the jingle from Lincoln, but we will. Don't worry, Alan Stevens, are you indeed there?
Hello.
Marvellous. The dulcet tones, of course, of the info at Caldor City person, or indeed just caldorcity.com, and indeed writer of the Unauthorised Guide to Blake 7, a whole heap of other things. Now, Shane Rimmer is in the studio, and how's it going so far, Shane? Do you think are we reasonably happy with how the show started?
You mean this morning?
Mm.
Yes, it's fine. It's exuberant. It's informative.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you get away with it, but neither of us are.
Oh, there we are. Good. I mean, because Shane, you did say, as somebody who's one of our regular phone out correspondents from the joys of the southern climes, etc., that it was nice to actually come into the studio. So we thought, actually, let's put on a show for yourself. You know, let's bring that together. Let's anchor the whole thing around. We've also, of course, got the delightful Sheila Rimmer, who I just heard also Shane's number one and key coordinator, manager and all sorts of other bits and pieces. And although he might have already identified this, Alan, we have a mystery voice for you.
Okay.
Are you ready for the mystery voice? Would you like to speak to Alan Stevens? Did you manage to identify that?
No, I didn't.
So, don't get a try.
Dear.
Who I am.
Well, I mean, I thought he might have. I mean, as Alan Stevens is a clear scholar of all matters to do with Coronation Street, as well as Doctor Who, I thought he would have identified you in one. Any ideas, Alan?
Coronation Street.
Yes, yeah, Coronation Street, Star Cops, Robin Hood, Spitting Image.
Yes, you got it.
Shane Rimmer was in.
Yeah.
Graham Harper.
Graham Harper. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, we are. I mean, you see, I don't know. He interviews you on stage in London and he can't identify you as a mystery voice. Unbelievable.
Hello, Alan.
Ungladly.
Mystery voice. Everybody.
It was rubbish, wasn't it?
Well, it fooled me.
Hmm. Oh, it was very little of it. That was the problem.
Anyway.
Because I was frightened.
How many months ago is it since you last actually spoke to Graham, Alan? Was it 3 or 4 months ago? Was that the last Who event or the Whovian package?
About a year.
All right. Oh, well, short-term memory, first thing to go. Have you any questions, Alan, you'd like? Because the joy of course, having Shane in the studio as well, is that there is the classic connection with William Hartnell.
Well, I was about to say that, because he played Seth Parker in a Doctor Who story called The Gunfighters in 1966.
Yeah.
Your character was shot dead by Doc Holliday, I remember, in the bar.
Right, I'm always getting shot, one way or the other.
Yeah.
Well, I enjoyed that. It was my first real live television. I mean, when I say live, I'm not behind a puppet or something like that.
Right, yeah.
But I had one sort of episode with William Hartnell, who came over the first day I was there. I mean, I hadn't done any television in this country before, and he said, "You're the real thing, huh?" I said, "What do you mean?" I sort of got out of his line of fire. I mean, he was a fairly menacing character when he wanted to
He's
be.
A grumpy old bugger.
Yeah. And
he said it again.
There he goes again.
He's on the BBC last night. It's just Graham Potty Mouth Harper. Unbelievable. He just apologised for that, dear.
I do apologise. Sorry, Shane.
I like it. Anyway, he said, "Are you from..." He automatically took that I was American. He said...
obviously, yeah.
"Are you from north or south of the... the Dixie Line." And I said, "Quite a bit north, Canada." And so after that we got along quite well. I mean, anyway, I was most impressed with the way he handled himself in the studio. He knew his way around, and he kept that show together, and he never let go of the reins. He was immensely good.
Yeah, I thought he was a very good actor. Around that point, he was having problems with he sort of fallen out with the producer.
Was he?
Originally.
I can understand that.
But yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a touchy situation at best, especially with a lead actor who gets some sort of clout, you know, because he's in that position. And there are bound to come up issues that they both don't quite agree totally on. But he was a hard man to... to counteract. He just knew the business extraordinarily well and played it extraordinarily well too, I thought.
Was Verity Lambert the producer then?
Well, what happened was that Verity Lambert had originally employed him, cast him in the part, and when she left, a producer called John Wells took over, which Hartnell did not see eye to eye with at all.
Right.
There was a huge eruption, and finally Wells resigned. And Innes Lloyd came in, and this was during the crossover between Innes Lloyd and in fact, it was Innes Lloyd that finally failed to renew Hartnell's contract, probably because he blotted his copybook by that point with the production team. So there was a lot of, I mean, William Hartnell had, he'd first come on, but he'd been cast with an ensemble cast. There was, Ian Chesterton and Barbara Wright and Susan. And as the show went along, those actors left the show, so he became... the focus of it, as it were, and I think, sometimes actors can go a bit berserk, can't they, when they realise that they're the last remaining element of the original lineup and the original production team, and he became very forceful over what he can and can't do.
Let me just hold it there, Alan. Graham, have you ever worked with any actors who've gone berserk? I obviously don't have to mention any names, but,
Yeah, I'm not telling you anything. I have, yeah.
It's frightening when that happens.
I have.
Sheila, from the point of view of an agent, I mean, ever had actors, I mean, because there is all sorts of relationships between actors and agents and so on. Did you ever have sort of any of the talent who you just thought, I can't deal with this person any longer?
All talent is self-indulgent and a pain in the butt. And you have to be lovely to them. I had a girl singer called Maxine Davis, a colour girl, and she was fantastic. And she was so neurotic that wherever I booked her, I had to get in the car and drive up there, even if it was Blackpool, because she fell apart, if you weren't there behind her. So I would say that in one way or another, they all need lots of back rubbing.
I say this to Graham every time when I do one of these shows. He doesn't take any notice whatsoever. He just says, sort it out. It's understandable.
I am self-indulgent. You're absolutely right.
I think Douglas Camfield got, I mean, a certain director did get on very well with him, Hart. I think Douglas Camfield got on enormously well with him. And of course, he did that 12-part Daleks Master Plan, and if after 12 weeks of working Hart, well, you've got to get on with him, or it would have been an absolute disaster. It was like a huge military project, Daleks Master Plan. I mean, it was just before.
Alan, I think even William Hartner would have kind of bowed a little bit lower to Dougie, because I think he took no prisoners. He was a very nice, warm personality. I'm talking about Douglas Camfield. Mm, yeah. And he, I never really met William Hartner, so I've no idea what he was like. I just heard the stories. But I think even William Hartner would have just kind of bowed to the presence of Douglas Camfield. You don't cross him.
It's fair to say that, actually, Graham, Douglas Camfield was one of the main people for making you the director you are today, really, because, I mean, you've often said that you've held him up as one of the inspirations in terms of the industry.
I think he really was a master of every aspect of making film or television. Mm. I think he was a hugely underrated director.
I think he was a superb director. I agree with Graham here. I've got a question for you, actually, Graham. I was watching the BBC film or whatever of Brideshead Revisited, which is basically like a kind of version of the one that was done by, was it Granada back in 1981?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you've seen it. I thought the original version, you know, back in 1981 was excellent. I saw it a couple of years back. I watched the BBC one, I think it was last week, I think, and I thought it was not very good. And one of the things I didn't like about it was a very busy camera, you know, as if, you know, an actor says a line and they think that the audience are going to sort of like start talking or switch over or whatever if the camera isn't continually moving around all the time, you know, cut, 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 as if the sentence is going to bore them. And I must say that, you know, I don't see that. It just seems to be a particular TV thing at the moment, and I certainly don't notice it in your work. I think you don't seem to be frightened of your actors or whatever, or feel your actors aren't up to it. I mean, what are your opinions on that?
I have to say, all the things. Whenever I talk to, for example, with Alexis, when I go to Lincoln University and talk to, or they ask questions to me of my career, etc., I always say it's called movies, even though we're in television. And for me, I use the word movies, meaning everything moves, the actors move, keep the camera alive, so that when you do have very powerful still moments, they're powerful, they really mean something. So I actually do, I'm an advocate of keeping the camera moving, but not zooming in and tracking in on every shot and everything, but to keep it alive, keep it more interesting, and also to complement what the actors are doing, to actually don't get in the way of it, to show it in the best way you can. So that's slightly different to what you're talking about, I think.
Shane, I'll just bring you in on this, because I'm thinking Stanley Kubrick and Lewis Gilbert, two folk you obviously worked with. Mm. Lewis Gilbert twice with Spy Who Loved Me and You Only Live Twice.
Yeah.
So a line that I think Lewis actually said, was quoted as saying on the sort of DVD release of You Only Live Twice, that he find it a lot easier to direct mega blockbuster epics than just four people sitting around a table. That was a lot harder. I'll put that question to Graham as well. I mean, which is easier? Because I know you've done both, the sort of the mega epic and the sort of simple or relatively simple one. I mean, obviously, get a camera crew in here, it could be a nightmare. Five individuals, where are we going to go to? who did you prefer? Well, what sort of style of director do you actually prefer as an actor?
I think you prefer somebody who gives you a little room for manoeuvre. Somebody, anyway, who will at least you feel comfortable talking to. And that really sets the tone of the picture. Actors can contribute quite a lot, sometimes too much, but they do have an order pull, I think, in that sort of situation. I mean, you're on the floor, you're using lines that are contributing to the part. So you must have some sort of substance to rely on.
And Christopher Nolan, director of Batman Begins?
Nonpareil. He's great.
Really? Right. So he's
young. He comes on the stage like detective with a raincoat?
Columbo.
That's what he looks. He doesn't look like Columbo because
one more thing?
He must be worth millions, and he comes on with his old raincoat down to his knees. And then the magic starts, and he is really quite something.
Graham, that's how we can get you a motion picture. Start wearing a raincoat down to your knees.
It's strange enough, every director I know who's made movies that I know all wear very long coats. Not Max necessarily, yeah, strange, down to the floor.
You've done too many German films.
Or too many Doctor Who's. But Alan, just to go back to what you were saying, I actually agree with you about a director using the cameras to just making the visuals so important, more important than what's going on, means he's afraid of the actors or afraid of the product he's got. And I'm talking about a different kind of moving of cameras. So you're quite right.
Yeah.
Sometimes they get in the way.
I was watching I finally caught up with Kick-Ass, Alex. I've watched that now.
Marvellous.
And I was watching listening to the director's commentary, and at one point the director, I can't remember, it's something Vaughan, isn't it?
Matthew Vaughan.
Yeah.
X-Men First Class.
He was saying, he was doing this particular scene, he said, if you believe in your actors, you don't have to continually move the camera around. He had this sort of like solid shot of his character and then back to the other one. And I think he's implying, and I think wrongly, of course, because he's probably a bit arrogant, that TV actors weren't up to it, and you had to move the camera around a lot, and I think that's obviously, wrong. But I think, there is a point here that, in watching Brideshead Revisited, the film, I just thought, this camera is so busy, it's actually distracting me.
Yeah. That's the look. Shane will have he's already had an opinion, and I'm sure he'll say something about what I'm about to say. But I think,
don't preempt him, Graham. You don't want to preempt him. He could go anywhere.
No, because it's what I'm about to say is really for Shane. Exactly. Is what he would want to say, not what I'm. From my point of view, when I started directing, I thought as a director I should try and do what it says on the tin and direct. And what you do is, when you start, you go in and you say, and I want this and I want that, and can you, and you before an actor's actually said one word of the script in a line run, you're telling him how you expect him to play it. And the secret is, I think, is that you allow actors to come on. You do a line run, and then you say, right, well, you've got to come through that door, you're going to be there to start with, I'd like you to start there, and you'd be there, and you set the whole thing up, and allow them to then, from that moment onwards, play the scene and see what happens. Even though you've got a plan of the visuals you want, just see what happens, allow them to do their thing, and then there's a collaboration, there's a negotiations of what you'd like to get out of it and what they would like to maybe get out of it, having just gone through
it's extraordinarily spooky you say that, because that's exactly the technique I was looking to use with Shane this morning when we were doing some readings for the Book of the Month. Mind you, Sheila had a few points as well. Slow it down, she was saying, slow it down, and it was good. We should really have had another DVD to actually go along with that. It's to sort of work on that basis.
I don't think it would sell, by the way.
One thing I would like to mention also is Shane appeared in with Dennis Hopper, one of my favourite all-time actors.
Oh, yeah.
In Space Truckers, which was a hugely enjoyable film.
A dangerous title.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I think intentionally there, yeah. One. I just wondered, I think that was one of the very few comedy roles that Dennis Hopper ever did, wasn't it? I mean,
well, deliberately, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, come on.
I was only kidding.
Yeah, I know.
Now, he had calmed down quite a lot.
Yeah, because he
getting a bit older, too, so maybe that goes with it. I had the thing that broke the ice with us, I mean, he was very concerned with his image, it was a funny old picture.
It was a great picture, though, Shane.
Yes, there was a well, when I say funny, I mean it
your
was a
villainous portrayal there. Exactly.
And Stephen Dorff, he reminded me so much of Bogart when he was young. He had that same kind of presence. I played golf with Hopper at a beautiful Dublin course. God, it's gorgeous. And he's a good golfer, quite a good golfer. And that sort of broke the ice.
The best thing about the film with your being in it was those silver jodhpurs you wore. Those baggy silver jodhpurs.
That sounds dangerously personal, Sheila, in all honesty, but it's fair enough.
She nicked them, actually. She had her eyes on them for a long time. I had jodhpurs, they're about the size of a tent.
I'm just looking at the strata here. They've shipped everything from square pigs to anti-gravity beer, but now they've got a whole lot of trouble.
I love the square pigs, actually. They're great.
Exactly. Space
square
truckers.
Meal, isn't it? That's
it's just amazing, amazing.
A square meal. Square pig.
Bliss. Well, that's sort of...
So but what were you saying? You were saying you played, you calmed down a bit since his wild days. I remember hearing he said a story once where he'd gone off on drugs and alcohol binge, and he'd woken up in a hedge with a dog bite on his leg, and he'd obviously realised he'd been in a fight at some point because he had a black eye, but didn't remember anything about it at all.
But around about sort of like mid-80s, he did Blue Velvet, didn't he? And suddenly he started getting film work again because they realised he had calmed down. I mean, what you know, was he a good golfer?
He was. He was. I mean, when he was on, he was quite terrific. I think he scored a mid-80s that day.
Oh, right.
And of course, that he hadn't played before. And it was delightful. I mean, he that put him in a good mood. He was in other sorts of moods during the picture sometimes, but yeah, he was okay. What you had to do with Harper was forget about his all the nonsense he's been up to for quite a while, because he's got into some pretty hairy episodes, and he wasn't kind to. He gave the director a bad ride, but otherwise he behaved himself pretty well. And when he's on, he's good.
Oh, yeah, I think that's fine, sir.
That's all I got to say.
No, that's fine.
That's good. Sorry, I'm just going to say, Bernadette, would you do that? It's all right, I'm not going to ask you to speak, but if you'd kindly actually just pop round to the main canteen area, sort out the necessary cups with respect to Graham, various other bits and bobs, then happiness will be personified. It's fairly straightforward to actually sort of out of the studio, and I realise if you're listening to this, you think, what's going on here? But it will be addressed. Meanwhile, as Bernadette hopefully goes to seek various sustenance, cups and various... Unbelievable, it's been that kind of day, Alan. He's chasing left, right and centre, but still. I hadn't realised, actually, Shane, that Alan is Alan's partner, Fiona, is also Fiona Moore from Canada.
Really?
Yeah, he comes from Toronto, yeah.
Oh. Gosh!
I know. It was astonishing. So, is Fiona around?
Canadians in Britain.
Yeah, I know. This is it.
We're going to form a club.
Yeah.
I don't know what we're going to call it, but we're going to form a club.
The Canadian club.
It is sort of true. I mean, do you ever get the harking back to sort of head back to Canada, Shane?
Yes, we haven't been back for a little while now, but when we go back, we head up north immediately. Up to the woods, up to the forests and Algonquin Park, mm-hmm. and these sort of things. And it's the one thing I miss about Canada, certainly being around London and being in this sort of atmosphere. You don't miss too much because there's so much here. It's the space, the land, the wildness of Canada, which is still there.
The snow.
And the snow.
Yeah.
You don't like snow anymore.
I don't like snow, and yes. No, I don't like snow. I threw away all my shovels and said, I'm not going to shovel another flake of snow. That's it.
Makes perfect sense.
I've got a question for you, Shane. Obviously, you play a lot of Americans, even though you're Canadian. Do you bother to change your accent at all, or do you think, well, you know, those Brits couldn't tell the difference anyway, so just do your normal voice?
What there is of it is normal. I tell you what, along the 49th parallel,
yeah.
which separates America from Canada, people within about 50 miles on either side, you can't tell a difference. Canadians can't tell a difference. Americans can't tell a difference. When you get out to the east and west coast, right to the end of that 49th parallel line, then, of course, the accents stand out. But right along that border, it's very difficult to tell one citizen from another.
So have you ever adapted your voice to try and be American?
No, I just try to be understood, and that doesn't work a lot of the time. So,
those kind of quotes that I go to make the whole thing. From Thunderbirds to Pterodactyls is, of course, the name of the book, which we will continue to plug. It will be the July book of the month, in fact, for Southside Broadcasting. So great stuff as far as that's concerned. Alan, any other questions you'd like to put to Shane or Sheila at present?
I've got loads of questions. I'd like to say to Graham...
Well, Graham's actually not in the studio at present.
Oh, God, goodness sakes.
Sorry. So we could relay it on to it, but no, it's just the excitement's too much. No, we'll be back shortly.
That's okay. I mean, you were in UFO, and what was the name of the actor who played...
Ed Bishop.
Ed Bishop, yes, of course.
And Michael Billington.
Yeah.
Because you two were the sort of... You were the two Americans, right?
Yeah, Ed was American, actually.
He was.
He was a New Yorker.
For British films or TV series, you know, you were there. They just knew. Because you came over in the 1950s, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. I mean, obviously a great move, because you've been in a huge amount of films and met a huge amount of great people. I mean, what was Kubrick like to work with, by the way?
He was lovely. At that time, he was quite free, of this sort of reclusive attitude that he came into, unfortunately, later on. He didn't like Hollywood. That's why he lived and much preferred to be in England.
Ah.
But he could get money any time he wanted to make a film. So, and we were taken on board deliberately as four rookie crewmen who really didn't know a throttle from anything else that was going on the plane.
Yeah.
James Earl Jones was the only one of us who had any kind of film experience. We were on the film for 13 weeks. 13 weeks, which is a long time.
And they still actually cut out the custard pie sequence.
And they cut out the greatest scene of the picture, which was a massive custard pie sequence that took 2 days to bring in all the pies, and then another day to throw them at everybody.
So that was the case of... I've often felt, actually, Alan, when you've been doing your audio dramas, that...
I need a custard pie fight. Yeah.
Exactly. You need a custard pie
fight. It doesn't work on audio so much.
It's a blodge, I suppose. I'm going to throw this in to Alan, because I know he appreciates this, where you get fantastically talented individual actors around from that basis. Alan, would you consider hiring Shane for use in one of the sort of fabulous audio productions you
I'm
do?
I'm thinking about it already.
There, yeah. You see.
I've got another question, actually. When did you get to meet Peter Sellers at all when working on the film?
Oh yeah, you didn't speak to Peter Sellers too much. Well, yes, that one I did. That one we did. But see, we were up in this plane,
yeah,
10 feet off the ground for all that time, and the rest of the action was taking place on the studio floor. Peter, you know, wonder he got and attained a level of acting and entertaining. Did he was he concentrated all the time. Except when he was giggling. He was a terrible giggler, and if he got... Oh, no, I can't say this on the air. But he was... once he started, he couldn't stop. So there was a great game going on in the studio between Sterling Hayden and Keenan Wynn, trying to make him...
Corpse. Yeah.
And they were pretty good at it until he finally... I think the production office lowered the boom and said, look, you know, we've got a very expensive picture going on here, and if you're going to go in the corner and giggle for half an hour, it's not helping the budget very much.
You think this is the Goons?
Yeah.
For God's sakes.
Yeah.
Sorted out.
But he was great. He, you honestly stood in awe of this man when you saw him transform himself from Sellers in his sort of civilian clothes and then going into a character. I mean, it was just amazing. He's one of those people who almost everything seemed to change.
Yeah, I mean, he played a number of different roles in that film, didn't he?
Yeah, I tell you what, he was supposed to play the pilot.
Yes.
But he broke his leg.
And he fell out of the plane. He got into a furious argument with Kubrick. And the flight deck was open at the front to allow the camera access to what was going on inside. And he got so carried away with his argument, he just kept on moving out and fell to the floor, broke his leg, and finished the picture in a wheelchair.
Well, that's interesting because I wasn't sure. There was a rumor that he just turned up with, he didn't want to play the part, and he just turned up with his leg in a cast one day and said he broke his leg, but he actually did break his leg.
He fell out. Now, 10 feet's a long way to go. No.
It is, yeah.
I mean, straight down. And it's a hard floor.
I speaking last year when I actually had a fall onto concrete at the end of the introducing MC announcing for the second literary. It's not good. It took me a few weeks to
give away at all.
The amazing thing was that he probably wouldn't have played Dr. Strangelove in a wheelchair if that hadn't happened. And that was the most incredible. Mm.
Yeah. Bit of magic, obviously, destiny brought together.
It was.
Alan Graham has returned. We've got time for one quick question because then we have to move on to another mystery voice.
I don't know what it was now.
he's sorted
I don't know what it was now. We've had a really good question for you, Graham, but you just walked out.
Listen, it was a minor emergency.
Sorry, I was not feeling very
exactly.
good. I'm better now.
Exactly. It's all silent. Ostromis. Fantastic. Alan, have you had a... actually, Graham, last two questions for Alan Stevens.
Where's my question?
let me think. I'm trying to remember what it was now. Good grief.
There's not what he wanted me to ask you. He wanted me to ask you if you had a...
I know what it was. I know what the question was.
Go on, my son.
Go on.
Okay. I was watching, actually, parts of the Invasion a couple of days back, you know, by again, directed by David Canfield. And one thing I did notice very clearly about the story was that anyone had any lines, you could understand exactly what their lines were. It wasn't just a case of good diction, it was a case of, you heard the dialogue. And I just wondered that, I do vote on some productions now, but sometimes the dialogue, is you've got to listen, really sort of concentrate, or it's sort of drained out, or it seems to be less emphasis on the dialogue. Is this just, like, not good directing, or is it down to a
just
a
get them to mumble.
Or is it shift away from a kind of like a theatre-type drama to a film-type drama, where dialogue is not so preeminent?
I think most of the productions made now are done by young people, for young people. They're not made for families and for...
It's a bit ageist, isn't it, Graham?
No, I think it's serious, because...
I agree.
Because most of the dialogue in British dramas...
Mumbles.
...is mumbled.
That's what subtitles are for.
You've got music, and you've got music effects. Everything's fighting everything. Mm. And actually,
flashbacks. Nothing but flashbacks.
And nothing but flashbacks. Dear. No, you're absolutely right, and flashbacks, and also you're told, so you're, everything's emphasised, you're told doubly what the story is about.
Previously on.
But you can't actually understand any of it.
No, I agree. And
actually now, there's such good sound equipment, the sound systems and desks that we work on now are so clever. You can actually get everything you want, and you can hear the dialogue. But it's still sort of... I don't mean it's not cared for by anybody. It seems to be, oh, they'll get it, they'll understand, because young people understand. Well, young people might understand the gobbledygook that goes on, but...
They might be too busy playing with their PlayStations.
I don't think they are. I think they actually, if they like the product, they'll watch it. So.
But even on films now, you know, the new films, you get big stars, and they're mumbled.
Yeah. I absolutely agree.
All
you have to do is say, can you lift the level up?
Exactly. Yeah, can you lift? I think a lot of it, too, is trying for a very natural kind of expression. I mean, Brando did it, but you could understand what he was saying.
Yeah, sure.
And now, couldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, and now it's, don't just talk like that, you know, if you're feeling not very good, you got to look it, you got to talk like it, you got to, everything.
Couldn't understand a word you said there, Shane, sorry about this. Sorry.
See, it worked.
That'd be a success.
Alan, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic chat?
It was incredibly interesting.
Marvellous.
Yes.
Are you back with us again very shortly?
Absolutely.
Hurrah!